Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And today we're going to talk to an entrepreneur who built a business that helped bloggers get more readers and then helped influencers get some revenue.
That's right.
His name is Dino Dogan. He is the co-founder of Triber, which enables content creators to get more shares. More recently, he bought, get this, madeinnyc.com. Madeinnyc.com. It's a science lab to run business experiments. It's an upcoming project that's soon to launch. Think of it like a virtual incubator. This interview is sponsored by two great companies. The first will help you hire your next great developer. So if you see something that Dino's done and you want to reproduce it, you can go to TopTal and basically hire the greatest developers ever to build it. And the second one is the company that will help you schedule meetings, really get people on the phone with you, whether they're your customers or soon-to-be customers or mentors, whoever. It's called Acuity Scheduling. I'll tell you more about both those later. First, Dino, welcome in.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. I use Acuity. I just tested it out. I love it.
Oh, good. When we do the ad, I'm going to ask you about that because I freaking love that software. Let me hit you with this. You sold the company, Triber. How much did you sell it for?
That's all the juicy stuff is under an NDA. So I'm
did you become a millionaire?
No, we did okay. I could take a year off comfortably and sort of focus on doing what I like to do or finding out what it is that I love to do. Because I had no idea, man. Mm-hmm. For 5 years, it was 100 miles an hour running Triber.
I saw you told our producer that you basically had nothing left to give, and we're going to get into that. Revenue, though, you did tell us the revenue in private. Tell the audience, at your height, how much a Triber produce?
I don't know. Last year, it was we were nearing I'm not even sure I'm allowed to talk about that
stuff.
Give
me ballpark.
So it was in the seven figures range. Let's say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then a share of that would have to go to the influencers who you were helping.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Big portion of that went to them.
We would take in the revenue. That was one of our monetization strategies. We would take in funds, obviously, from like marketing agencies, brands, whatever, and organize influencer marketing campaigns through our platform and with our community, with our influencers. And of course, sharing the profits from that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Before you were doing that, you told our producer, I was a corporate drone working for Accenture. Give me a typical day in the life. What did you do?
Oh, man. So, you know, Tim Ferriss talks about 4-hour work week.
Yes.
I had a 15-minute work week. Remember Office Space? And guy was like, I on a good day, I worked like 45 minutes.
Doing what?
Or whatever. In my case, it was even worse. I was working maybe like 15 minutes a week. It sounds incredible. It was like everything else was meetings and planning and strategy and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So obviously I'm being a little hyperbolic when I say corporate drone and 15 minutes. But it is. So
it's a lot of time spent in meetings and very little time actually producing. And the time that you were producing, you were a consultant?
No, full-time employee at Accenture.
No, I mean a consultant on their behalf?
Internally, in-house.
What did that mean? Give me a typical project.
We had – it was a huge project. So we had a development team. I think there was about 150, 200 people on the dev team. And we had huge clients. Out of like top 50 insurance providers, Allstate, Merrill Lynch, so on. Life insurance providers. We had like 48 of them, and we're running their software on our platforms, the test bed for their software.
So
it was developed at Accenture. It was tested with us. They would access like early beta releases from us. And I was in charge of the networking piece of that entire equation.
And while you were there, did you start these side businesses because you had all this extra time? You did.
Yeah, I did.
Tell me about the dog training business.
Yeah, that was a huge fun. I loved dogs, always have. Grew up with dogs. It's just my favorite thing ever. So I figured, you know, I'm bored. Let's see if I can do something else. And dog training was like, I loved learning about dogs. I love, training dogs. And let's try to make a run out of that. So I started a blog that took me in one direction that eventually led to Triber. And I tried to make it into a business. It didn't work. I didn't know how to build a business. I didn't know how to build a dog training business.
I thought it was interesting that you told our producer, you know what? I thought accounting would be really difficult.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, so one of my early businesses, so in my 20s, I blew through like 5 different businesses, just trying things out, right? Mm-hmm. I launched this business that was essentially Redbox. Do you know Redbox?
Yeah, that's the service. It's DVD a box at the supermarket where you get to rent a DVD for a buck.
Right. So I had 2 of those. They weren't Redbox. They were like off-brand or whatever. And I had them in supermarkets, and that was like my initial business. And I remember being like really flustered and frustrated by the whole every quarter submitting your tax, you know, tax information and doing the accounting and bookkeeping and stuff like that. Oh, I hated learning all that stuff.
You know, let me tell you something about that, by the way. I hate doing that, the quarterly taxes too. There was a Mixergy guest who said, screw it. I decided I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to pay the penalty. So I went back to my accountant and I said, can I just pay the frickin' penalty? How much is it? My accountant told me how much it was. I think it was like a couple of $100. I said, screw that. I'm not going to spend a minute on this if all I have to do is pay a couple $100. And then I also don't have to pay the money up front. I get to pay it at the end of the year. Now, I'm not recommending people in the audience do it, but I'm telling you, that's what I learned. That's what I'm doing now. Yeah. It's a pain in the ass.
That's amazing. Right? I had no idea. Yeah. I love this. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, interesting that Redbox competitor didn't work out. You bought the vending machine, you put it in places, you stacked it with DVDs, people got to go in and rent them and return them. Why didn't that work out?
I blew $50,000 and 2 years of my life on that particular business. It didn't work because there wasn't enough foot traffic.
Got it.
If you think about it, right, Redbox is going to take all the prime locations.
Right.
Right. What's left for guys like
me? What did you get? Where did you put it?
It was a supermarket, but it wasn't, you know, a huge supermarket with a ton of traffic.
Okay.
So it was like, you know.
All right. So you said, you know what? I can see that there are going to be some issues. You imagined that accounting might be an issue with this dog training business. And instead, what became the issue?
Customer acquisition.
Okay.
Became the issue, right? And then I started learning marketing. I'm like, all right, I'm a smart guy. I'll figure out this marketing thing. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of led into Triber. But yeah. That's a whole other story. But dog training was a lot of fun. Do you have a dog?
You know what? I still think I do. I had a dog for the longest time, and then he kept trying to bite my son when we had the baby. And then before that, he was biting guests at my parties. And, you know, I have people over a lot. And so it was becoming an issue between the guests and my friends. So my friend has got him in New Jersey, and it's kind of painful that we're not together.
Yeah.
I get the love and the bond for a dog, and I get why you'd want to create a business to train dogs. Training my dog was just such a satisfying experience. It felt like I could communicate with the dog. It also got him to feel more comfortable in the world because he knew what he was doing right. He knew what was expected. You then start to Google around and you say, how do I get traffic to my site? You're cracking up. And when you Googled, what did you find?
Well, so it was really funny, and I didn't understand the hypocrisy of it at the time, but or self-servingness of it at the time. But if you Google, hey, Google, how do I get traffic to my website? Google will say the answer is Google or SEO, search engine optimization, right?
I'm going to do it right now.
And I didn't see the self-serving nature of that answer, right? And what I've learned through a lot of trial and error is that SEO is great for transactional type of sales. You want to sell a widget, you want to sell a product. You're not looking to build a relationship with the customer. SEO is great, right? But being in the dog training business, it's not transactional. It's very personal, right? And that just wasn't the right answer for me. But I only figured that out after I did SEO for a while. Right? It took a while to figure out that wasn't going to work.
Were you doing dog training as an info product?
No, just in life.
You personally?
Yeah.
Why would a guy at Accenture think so small? Dog training one-on-one is never going to be a huge business.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to build a huge business.
It was just, I got to have my own business.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of saw, maybe somehow I knew that I would do some sort form of entrepreneurship eventually. And I figured this would be a kind of a nice on-ramp.
Okay.
And here's what's important about all of this, really, is that the idea or the impetus or whatever it is that gets you off your ass and trying something and learning something and failing at something and going through something, that's good enough.
I see.
Because it's just a learning process. And as long as you engage in that and sort of plan accordingly, it's a great process to engage in.
I see. If you were just listening to Mixergy interviews, you'd go nowhere. But if you were starting out like a dog training service, even if it was never going to be huge, at least it got you into entrepreneurship. And then you start to come across problems. Then you find naturally answers. Then that leads to more questions, more answers. And one of the things that it led you to was this community of people who are all blogging, who are commenting on each other's blogs. We're talking right now like 2010, 2011. And that put a thought in your head. What's the idea that you got from seeing this little community?
Yeah, I noticed that in order to build this kind of a personal business, right, the personal relationship business, bloggers were really good at it, and they understood that part, and people visited each other's blogs, commented on each other's blogs. I share your stuff with my audience. You share your stuff, my stuff with your audience. Now multiply that just beyond us two, multiply that by 20 or 40 or whatever, right? And that's what I had with my little dog tribe.
Yep.
I had, you know, a couple of few dozen of faithful readers that have helped me tremendously throughout. And what's funny is that then they followed me to Triber, that dog community, right? Because they were some of the first users of Triber.
What kind of things did you do? You actually... You contacted them by email and you said, hey, we're both in the same dog space. I'm reading your stuff. I like it. You commented on their stuff. They came to your site and read some of the articles that you wrote for search engine optimization reasons. They commented there. You guys became friends. The business never went anywhere. But you said, I see this thing. And what did you want to do with it? That's the part I'm not following.
Well, I didn't know. I didn't know, right? I just knew that SEO wasn't quite the answer, and I was getting some traction just by having these personal relationships, mostly in person, not so much online. But online, it gave me a kind of a degree of notoriety and authority to sort of present myself to you in person as a dog trainer. So that was a pretty important bit, right? Like this guy kind of sort of, I can trust him that he kind of sort of knows what he's talking about, right?
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And then those guys followed me into Triber. And
yeah,
then
so
obviously
how'd you get the idea for Triber?
So in order for me to see what 50 of my best friends online are doing, I have to go to 50 different blogs. I have to leave 50 different comments. I have to click share, you know, 50, or if I want to share it to multiple destinations, you know, 100 times or 150 times, right? So you add that up and it really limits how much you can do per day and how far you can scale that. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I wish there was a solution that would maybe use RSS to like pull in all the 50 blogs into a single feed. And then from that feed, I can comment and that comment goes to the blog. And then from there, I can like schedule it to get it shared. I'm like, is there such a tool? And there wasn't.
I see.
I spent like 3 days looking for it. There wasn't such a tool. There were similar tools. But not doing quite what we were doing.
Yeah, because like Google Reader would allow you, and any RSS reader would allow you to read all those blogs, but you don't want to just do that. You want to comment so that the people who write those blogs would understand that you're in their world and then care about you and nurture you as a relationship, and that did not exist.
That did not exist.
Then you contacted Dan Christo. Who is Dan Christo to you?
Man, you've done your research. That's amazing. Yeah. So Dan is a buddy of mine. We met when we started arguing in a Social Media Examiner article that I wrote a bunch of years ago. It was a super friendly argument. And I noticed that he lives in Jersey, which is where I live. And I noticed that he's big into SEO. And you already kind of got my spiel on SEO. I was like, right in that time, I was like really trying to figure it out. And I'm like, cool, bro, let's do some podcasts, right? So we did a bunch of podcasts. We found that we jive really well together. And I knew that at the time, Dan had another platform called Flutter. Flutter was Vine 5 years before Vine.
Mm-hmm.
It was essentially video Twitter. Way before its time. This is like 2009, 2000.
It was pretty popular.
What was?
Flutter. It had some attention. I'm not saying like huge traffic, but it had attention.
We may be thinking of a different Flutter.
Maybe I am.
Yeah.
Right?
Because it was spelled weird.
How was it spelled?
Oh, geez. F-L-A. I think there was like two T's and then, well, maybe there was an R-S, Flutters. I forget. But I knew he could code, right?
What? Wait, so did the business fail? Is that why?
Flutters?
Yeah.
That was his side project.
But he never took off.
Never took off.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Yeah. Maybe I am thinking of something different, but I remember that there was, for some reason, Flutter sticking in my head. Okay.
I know there's a startup out of Florida, at least it was about 2-3 years ago, with the same name. So
yes,
maybe you think
the live feed for Community Buzz.
Maybe.
I'm on their site now. Okay. All right. So you knew that this guy could actually produce something.
Right. Okay. Right. And I had this idea, and we got together in Montclair, New Jersey, and sat down, and we sort of sketched it out. And 3 days later, he coded it. Like 3 days later, we were like sharing each other's stuff across and whatnot. And then 3 weeks later, we opened it up to beta users and never looked back.
What was in that first version?
Oh my God, it looked so terrible. The UX just didn't even exist. It was cobbled together. There's some early pictures. Like if you Google Triber and like limit it to like 2011, you'll see the mess it was. It was terrible. It was very basic, but it worked.
I got to tell you, I've looked at it recently, just as recently as a few hours ago. It's just really well done now. But I could imagine that it was a rough start since you guys pulled it together in what, like a matter of weeks, right?
We didn't know what we were supposed to do, so we just did what felt natural, right?
What were the features that were in there?
Pulling the RSS feed so that it's in the news feed, whatever. Tribal stream, we called it.
I like it.
Yeah. And you could schedule those articles to be shared to Twitter, Facebook, G+, whatever it was around, LinkedIn, whatever it was at the time. And you can leave a comment. And then that comment, which eventually deployed the commenting system, and that comment would then appear on your blog, and you could leave a comment on the blog.
So I could, from your reader, I could comment on somebody else's site?
Yeah, yeah. That was a feature we had.
That's really cool. All right. I know that people were looking for that back then.
We had so many cool features, man.
But you know what? Here's the thing that I'm seeing on the first version.
Uh-huh.
Guaranteed retweets. That was the big thing, right? That somebody could subscribe to a tribe. A tribe is a group of people who all share the same interests and care about each other's work. And it automatically would tweet every post from that tribe to your feed. So everyone would basically be automatically retweeting everyone's stuff, right?
That was very early on. Once we loosened up the permissions to grow your tribe beyond, I think initially it was like 7 people, right? So we kind of loosened up the permissions to like 30. And then, of course, a tribal size of 30 with the auto setting, right? That creates a lot of activity, right? Today, that activity would be like considered moderate to low.
Setting up that many tweets.
Yeah, but back then it was a lot. We didn't tweak the auto setting. And then very quickly we brought in auto used to be default. Then we made it like an option to enable it, and manual was the option.
Okay, so I did do some searches limiting the search results to the early years of your company, and I'll come back in a moment and talk about what I found there. And you're smiling because you know it, and you've handled it. We'll talk about it. Some of it was pretty brutal, to be honest with you, right? But you're smiling, which is good. Let's talk about my sponsor
first, and then come back
and get into that. Sorry?
In terms of the critics you're referring
to?
Yeah, cool.
It was a love-hate relationship with a lot of love and a lot of hate. But we're going to get into that in a moment. First, Acuity. How do you use Acuity?
So I have a fake link in my dinodogan.com/calendar. So it's like one of those redirect links, and it goes to Acuity. Mm-hmm. So when I want to schedule an appointment with somebody, I just send them, you know, dinodogan.com/calendar. They click on that. They go to Acuity. It may have expired if you try it now.
No, it works.
Oh, cool. And sends them to Acuity, and I don't have to worry about, like, hey, you have a open time on Tuesday or Wednesday, or, you know.
Yeah. Who do you want to talk to that you set this up for?
Andrew, I do this kind of thing like several times a day with people I'm working with, people I'm looking to work with.
You just have it. I'm on yours right now. You're just saying you use it for anytime everything. Someone wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
You just send them that link. Instead of what I do is I set one up for interviews. I set another one when I want to sell. I sell another one for like 15-minute conversations. Just have one. Anyone who wants to talk to you, here's the link. Go do it.
I don't advertise it to anyone. You know what I mean? But
you just did.
I just did, right. No, I mean, it's okay. If we should be talking, then by all means. Otherwise, you're wasting your time, right? I just have one thing and I send it to literally everyone. Like if it's not in my calendar, I will forget it.
Me too. Or worse still, it's in my calendar and then it's time for the call and I go, I don't have their freaking phone number. I forgot. Yeah. Did we say we're going to do it on mine? You have your phone number, whatever. Right. So I see yours. What you did was you have one page for Dino Dogan and you ask for people's phone number, but you also optionally let them give you a Skype ID. That way, as soon as it's time to go, it's on your calendar with their phone number. I've seen some people do that where they have one universal link for anything. If you're out there and you're having trouble connecting with people, just set this up. In fact, what Dino did, you could do too. Just have it redirect to Acuity. Or, Dino, here's what I do. I'd suggest this for you. You can take this calendar that they give you from Acuity Scheduling and embed it on your site so it looks like it's completely yours. People don't even need to know that they're on Acuity. It just seems like, Dino coded this up. So here's the problem that this solves. Anyone out there who's like Dino have occasional meetings, maybe several a week, where people are trying to hook up with you and get the right time. Oh, it'd be interesting for hookups. Think about that. Do you want to hook up tonight? Here's my calendar. I'm available only on Fridays at 9:30 p.m. Well, can you imagine if I was dating and someone met me and we exchanged phone numbers and I'd say, you know what, do you want to go out? You say, yeah, when? Go, here's my Acuity hookup calendar.
Yeah.
You don't think that would work?
I don't know. Depends how much he likes you.
I believe I had enough charm that I would have been able to pull that off. It took me years to get to a place where and a lot of like coaching to get to that place. Yeah. Actually, it's not even a lot of coaching, a lot of therapy. Mm-hmm. But it worked. Yeah. But back to business. If you're out there and you need to connect with people on a regular basis, and it's a pain in the ass, all you have to do is go to Acuity Scheduling, create one calendar for yourself, set how long you want it to be for, and that's it. You get a URL. If you happen to schedule something on Monday at noon, it automatically is wiped off of your availability on Acuity. So the next person you send that link to or every person you've sent it to in the past will not be able to connect with you or schedule an appointment with you at Monday at noon. It's that beautiful. If there's something you need, like I know there's some companies that work with people internationally and they need a Skype ID, so they ask for a Skype ID. If there's another way that you would rather connect with someone, like for me, I like to use this meeting software. I intentionally add my meeting software link to their calendar invitation so they know that's how we're going to meet. But I also want their phone number as a backup.
Right.
The other thing that it's useful for, if you have new customers that you want to welcome properly, you can send them a link. They could schedule a call with you or someone on your team so that you can understand why they signed up for your software, make sure that you onboard them properly, maybe even do a demo for them. If there are people who come to your site and they're not yet bought in, instead of just having a buy button or go away option, you say buy or schedule a call with us. And let them schedule a call with you where you can explain to them why they should be signing up and understand what their needs are. Once you do that, one of the problems you might have is, you know, you've got someone in your calendar. Maybe you want them in your email software. Well, Acuity will plug into your email software. Maybe you want them in your address book. Acuity will connect with your address book. Maybe you want to add them to a spreadsheet. I have no idea what you want to do with them, but Acuity will hook up with all of those things. Go to the special URL where you can sign up for Acuity and start using them for free, whether you're using them for business or using them for hookups. Go to acuityscheduling.com/mixergy, acuityscheduling.com/mixergy. Mixergy. They're a fantastic company.
Which, well, that's interesting. Sorry, interrupted you. It's interesting. I had no idea of all these extra features of Acuity. That's cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm telling you, man. It's so cool. So here's what I do with it. If you schedule a call with me, I automatically have you added to – I have this I'll mention the company. I use Pipedrive because I want to keep track of where someone is in my flow. So as soon as you you go in Acuity, you're in column one of Pipedrive, and then I get to keep – making sure that we don't just have this phone call, but that I follow up on the phone call, and then I either get you to buy or I mark you as a lost sale. Mm-hmm. Anyway, once you get Acuity, it's kind of fun to play around with it.
Yeah, that's super smart. It's I'm learning to process size and systemize everything and sort of set up a pipe drive in that way. And that's really clever. Yeah, you need it.
Yeah, you know what? It's ever since I had a kid, I just cannot waste a minute. There is no single wasted second in my life. It just does not exist.
Yep.
Really, to the point where if I am walking from the kitchen to the bedroom, my mind is going, is there something I need to pick up along the way and get to like my nightstand? Do I take the Kindle, put it by my nightstand so I could read?
Yeah, I understand.
I've been reading Hillbilly Elegy because every liberal on the planet seems to be reading it to try to understand the other side. Do you know this book?
No.
J.D. Vance, he talks about his life growing up as a hillbilly and how he became, I think, an investment banker later in life. I thought it was just going to be this homework assignment to try to understand what was going on in Appalachia. Uh-huh. It's a fan-frickin-tastic read because he gets so personal about his life, about his mom like hitting him to the point where he had to run to a stranger's backyard. He talks about the love and affection he got from his grandparents, but also what it was like for his grandparents to move from like hillbilly country to a place where they got, what was it? Blue collar work, steady blue collar mm-hmm. work. And how do you deal with that? Right. It seems like a step up. You should be happy. But, you know, their personalities weren't necessarily ready to go into a store where someone might tell them you can't do something. They take it as an affront. They actually they walked in when he was a kid. He walked into the store. He started playing with the toy. The manager at the store said, I'm sorry, you can't play with the toy while you're in the store. You either buy it or you put it away. So the kid stands outside the store. His hillbilly grandparents, I think it was his grandparents, find out about this. They walk in the store and they say, did you tell my son this? And the guy says, yeah, we're not supposed to let people play with our toys unless they buy it. So the grandparents take the toy, they smash it on the floor, and then they start smashing other toys because you will not put down their family.
Wow.
Right. And he goes, this is where they come from, this past where you're supposed to protect the family, move to this world where you're supposed to behave differently, and they haven't yet acclimated, and there are challenges involved with that. And as a result, we still have this hillbilly-ishness in us. Such a good read.
That is insane, but I get it. I saw this documentary a bunch of years ago about a situation in Albania, or at least there was a situation maybe a decade or a few ago, where there were these blood feuds, right? And you have heads of the family, right? It's Albania, right? So in terms of economic opportunities, there's not a lot there, right? And the economic opportunities that exist, they exist for men of a certain adult age, right? But these men of adult age would get into these blood feuds, kill another person, right? Yep. And now that person's entire family is after you, and you have to confine yourself just onto your property. And you can't leave that property because the second you do, someone's going to jump you. And this has become so ubiquitous that it just stilted the economic growth of the entire country.
Let me ask you this. You're from Bosnia. Did you have any adjustments coming to the U.S. from Bosnia? What was a big one?
You know what was a big one? And I love telling this one because it's so like seems insignificant, but I think it's instructive. I was in New York eating a falafel, and my girlfriend at the time was sitting next to me, and there were two other people across from us, and growing up in Bosnia and eating in Bosnia, it's considered rude to speak while you eat.
Like in between bites or
while in between you're... bites.
So certainly. I take a bite. I fully swallowed. I had a little bit of water. I can't talk to you.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's hard for you to even imagine that, right? But no, it's a proper thing, etiquette thing to do, to sit down, you eat your meal, and you are silent while you do this. Sometimes adults will speak, right? But it's very sort of, out of necessity rather than a conversational type of speaking to one another. I mean, sure, once you're done with the dinner, then you sort of, you know, open up and whatnot. But I was eating and I was like really into my food and just being a nice little boy and eating my food and not speaking. And Fedra, that was my girlfriend at the time, she's like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. What's, you know, she's like, you're not saying anything. I'm like, oh, that's how you guys do this in America, huh?
Yeah.
All right. All right. I can adjust.
I had a weird issue like that too with a girlfriend where we don't have, or we didn't growing up, we weren't supposed to have girlfriends over to the house. You're not supposed to date. You're not supposed to kiss anyone. Like there's like real restrictions on it. I remember going
My
to this.
My parents were fine with that.
Sorry?
My parents were fine with that.
They were?
Yeah.
Because they were in Bosnia, can you do that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, Europe is a very secular place in general.
But Bosnia is a little bit different. I don't see too many people walking around with tespis outside of Bosnia and maybe Turkey, for example.
I don't even know what a tespi is.
You don't? Are you really Bosnian? But isn't that like bead thing that you guys have?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to have to look it up.
All right.
But yeah, we can come back to that. Tell me your story.
I just remember going over to a girl's house and like I'm not supposed to hide from her parents. We're just sitting on the couch having a conversation like we're adults. And the whole thing felt really like wrong. Like I just committed a murder, you know, like how am I getting away? We're sitting here. Do you understand we're dating? Very weird. Okay. All right. Back to you. Here's what I found when I did a search.
Uh-huh.
Here's one from Solo PR. Every time you publish a new post, everyone in your tribe will tweet to their followers, and you do the same for everyone in your tribe. But if you can't take the time to read the post that you're tweeting because they auto-tweet, why should your readers take that time? Mm-hmm. So that was a big one, right? You auto-posted for everybody. And that's what allowed you guys to grow. You're nodding your head. Tell me, what do you think about that? Wasn't that a big issue that you guys were a little aggressive with the retweets?
Oh, yeah. We were definitely aggressive. But also this is very early on, right? Eventually we had to sort of turn it down. Twitter, that was, in the pre-interview, that was one of the, questions, like what was one of the early milestones? I'm like, when Twitter sent us an email to tell us to, cut this thing out.
Because they didn't like that people were auto-tweeting everyone else's stuff.
Well, so yes and no, right? Auto-tweeting is fine. Like Hootsuite does it. There's all these tools back then that existed, still do, a lot of them, that do the exact same thing, right? What they were concerned about was first the volume. Like all of a sudden, this company out of nowhere started bubbling up in their sort of developer ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. And they were like, and they couldn't figure out what was going on, right? They couldn't figure out why I would share your stuff automatically, right? They didn't see the other side where, you know, you share my stuff automatically as well or manually, whatever. So in any case, we got on their radar. That was really cool, but they were really nice. They were like, guys, we don't really understand what it is that you're doing. Can you explain? And, you know, we did. And they're like, okay, could you like back off a little bit? I'm like, yeah, sure.
Okay. And back offing meant what?
Back off meant if we went from automatic to manual. Right. Mm.
So then it became, I as a user log into the site, I have my tribe, other people who also have, let's say, startup blogs, like I have a startup blog, I see all of their posts, I get to read them if I want to, or share them if I choose to do that.
Correct.
Or just keep scrolling to the next one and the
or
next one.
Just scrolling, exactly.
Got it. And when I tweet, it's a tweet with a comment if I want to. At least
you
the way,
could
that's
do
the way
that.
It works today.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an early feature, actually. Yeah,
you could. So I understand how this solves a problem for bloggers. They always were trying to get exposure. They always were trying to get more tweets. They always were trying to get more readers. What about you? Where was the revenue going to come from?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So we had some fun monetizing Triber. We actually monetized Triber 3 weeks to its existence.
Wait, three weeks into it?
Yep.
Okay, all right. Because you're bootstrapped.
Well, we bootstrapped, and also we saw no need to wait. Maybe if we were smarter and more experienced, we would have seen a need to wait.
No, I think it makes sense.
But we just went with it, and we monetized through virtual currency we called Bones. Virtual currency was particularly big. Go back in like 2010, 2011.
What did you call it, virtual currency?
Bones. Because it's Striver, okay, yeah. Tribe, Bones, you know, it's the whole thing. Farmville on Facebook was big at the time as well. They had virtual currency. Gamification was big at the time. Everyone was talking about it. So we gamified the platform, and it worked really well. We were converting at 12%, whereas in virtual currency space, the average is more closer to like 7%-ish, if you're lucky. Like Farmville was doing 7% conversion on their virtual currency. At least the point that's in my memory. I'm sure it went like that. And it was really good. We were converting at about 12%, and we did that for about 2 years, and then we switched to a different model. It was essentially freemium. That was one monetization pillar or channel, if you will. And in 2014, we rolled out influencer marketing. That was another sort of monetization.
What would I get with my – if I paid you and got virtual currency in the beginning, what would I get or what could I spend it on?
So one of the things was to put your tribe mates on auto. Talk about
– I could pay to get others to auto tweet. Got it.
No. For you to auto-tweet others.
Oh, so people would pay to be able to tweet more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, more often and sort of a hands-off kind of way.
What else? What else would I be able to pay for?
Oh, geez. Larger tribes. There was some, we call them higher level functions. I forget everything that was in there. But it was like more of, you had sort of a, for free you reach a certain limit.
Okay.
And it was really generous, like three tribes, 30 people per tribe. You know, it's 90 people sharing your stuff. That's a lot. Just keep it relevant and you're fine, right? But then, you know, for people who wanted to go beyond that and sort of automate certain tasks, they could pay extra.
Okay. How long before you were making enough money to actually make a living at this?
So I haven't paid – no one got paid for like the first 2 years. Not because we necessarily couldn't. We just wanted to like just put all the money back into the business. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, eventually we grew to about six people, a few freelancers and contractors that helped us along.
So how did you live before you took money out?
Oh, well, me personally?
Yeah.
So I've always had like little side gigs that I do. I did pretty well for myself in the corporate world. So the location that I worked at closed down in 2010. Mm-hmm. So I had a choice to either move to Chicago or take severance package. I took severance package. It was pretty sweet. So I was set for a while. By the time that ran out, Triber kicked in. So it was all good.
So I see how this thing is starting to grow. I see how you're starting to get customers. At some point, you had an opportunity to take funding to supercharge this growth, and you turned it down. Talk about that. What happened?
Andrew, what happened is that 30-year-olds are dumb. Maybe not all 30-year-olds, but I'll tell you, I was. And I don't mean that intellectually. Man, I am smart when it comes to intellectual stuff. Put anything in front of me, I'll learn it, I'll do it. I'm an engineer. I'll figure it out, right? In that way, I don't feel inadequate in any way. Emotionally, being able to look at a situation with a certain detachment and distance and from all angles, I just didn't have that when I was in my 20s and even most of my 30s. That's only now sort of starting to bubble up as I've turned 40 last year. And I feel 50, like I'm looking at 30-year-olds as like I've aged 20 years in 1 year. It's hilarious because I used to feel like I was in my 20s and now I feel like I'm in my 50s.
Okay.
Anyways, So it's just emotional maturity, right? We had these opportunities. They came to us.
They just found you online.
Yeah.
Okay.
We were making a lot of noise. There was a lot of Triber activity out there.
How? Because people were tweeting out your short link every time they would share. So
that was part of it.
Investors would suddenly see the short link show up on their Twitter feeds a lot. What else? Yep. What else did you do?
I was everywhere. If there was a conference with five people in it, I was speaking at it.
I saw you spoke at New Media Expo. Rick Calvert, I've got emails from him from 2013 announcing that you and Pat Flynn are speaking at events.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I see that.
Yeah. So NMX used to be called Blog World. It was the largest blogging conference. I mean, think yep. about it. That's like, that's all of my people, right? So in any case, somehow we had a couple of investors from California hear about us. I'm not even sure how. But they approached us and we just didn't want to like have a serious discussion with them because I didn't want to lose control over Triber. Like, I'm the only one that knows what needs to happen. I need to maintain control. It's completely stupid. If you have an opportunity to take money, take money.
How much were you offered? Did you even get to that point?
We didn't get to that point, but the discussion was around $600K to $800K. That was like sort of the initial discussion.
Got it.
And that's the amount of money we thought we needed, and they accepted the premise. But we never got far enough to actually make it happen.
And then there was a period there where we were thinking of raising money and things got a lot harder and it wasn't available. Yeah. And let's get to that in a moment. But first, I've got to tell you about my friend Shane Mack here in a spot for Top Towel. You don't know Shane. But when you want to understand the difference between Silicon Valley thinking and the rest of the world, funding is what most people pay attention to. What they don't pay attention to is this thing. I won't even turn my phone around that he tweeted to me a couple of nights ago. He said, Andrew, let's go out for a drink. I said, go out for a drink. Why? Someone that he's been looking to hire, and he's getting close. I'm trying to think of what I can say and what I can't. He basically has said, I congratulate him. He goes, 6 months of work. 6 months he's spending to hire the right person for the right job. 6 months of meetings, of talking to people, of figuring out who the right person is, then meeting those people and so on. If you want to understand the difference between Silicon Valley and the rest of the world, funding is a clear element. But another element that's completely underappreciated is the obsession with hiring the right person. The funding often is there to make sure that you can pay for the brilliant minds who are going to build things, because if you hire the right person, they're going to grow your business way bigger. They're going to open your eyes to new ideas. Now, how does the rest of the world think? A lot of times I see people think, I've got to hire. I've got a great deal on this guy from this country that I don't even know how to pronounce. And it's okay because their whole country is going through some kind of financial crisis, so I can hire him right now cheap.
Or is this the country America? Sorry.
A month. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Is the country America?
right, exactly. So.
But I get this problem.
Yeah, that's the difference. Mm-hmm. So the people over at Top Towel, these are really smart guys. Said, we actually can make this better. Let's disrupt this whole system. Hiring is a bitch. Hiring is tough, especially when it comes to developers. So we are going to go out there and create a process for the best developers to want to work with us. And that process for TopTal involves creating the most insanely difficult engineering challenges possible to make sure that they're hiring the best of the best and putting them in their network. That they're only finding the best of the best in their network. Excuse me. Not hiring them, but they want the best of the best. So 97% of people who take these tests don't even make it past, don't even get accepted. The top 3% end up in TopTal's network. When a company needs to hire the best of the best developer, they get paired up, not with a developer, but with someone inside TopTal's matching team. And that matcher will understand what the company's needs are, what projects they're working on, what languages. Do they need someone for one project? Is it a part-time gig that's ongoing? Is it a full-time thing? Whatever it is. Then they go into their network and they find the right person and they match you up with them. And if it's a good fit, you can start within days. Now, Shane, unfortunately, did not need a developer. He needed other things. But you could bet that he and others get insanely driven when it comes to finding the right developers. And that's what makes their companies grow. If you're out there and you're ready to find someone or many people who are the best of the best, There is one place that you can go, and frankly, don't just take my word for it. Ask other companies. You'll see. The reputation is spectacular. That is why Andreessen Horowitz, the bluest of blue chip venture firms, has put in so much money into TopTal because they believe in this model. Mm-hmm. All right. Lucky for us, it started by a Mixergy fan. And so if you are listening to me, the Mixergy, actually two different Mixergy fans co-founded this company. They have offered us something they're not offering anyone else. 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. If you want that, go grab it right now. TOPTAL.com/Mixergy. Top as in the best of the best. Tal as in talent. You really want people who've got that talent in their bones. TOPTAL.com/Mixergy. All right, let's continue with this story. You now, at this point in the story, are starting to go after bigger companies, and it's you personally. I'm amazed. You got Sears as a customer.
Sears,
Tom's, we had Shoes of Tomorrow.
Tom's Shoes, yeah. Al May, which I didn't even know what it was until we ran a campaign for them.
What were they paying you for?
So we built a project management platform inside Triber for brands to run these campaigns, right? So like kind of, you know, it's kind of like a project management tool, right? So they were paying us for that, and they were paying us for access to the influencers. We did most of the heavy lifting when it comes to influencers, what they need to do, how to build a campaign page and stuff like that. So there was a service component as well, which I really abhorred, but we did it for a while. So yeah, that's what they were paying us for.
Is it that you basically were letting them buy blog posts written by these people? That's what it was?
No. I'll give you an example. When we ran a Tom's Shoes campaign, we went out and we hired, I don't know, maybe 35, 40 people to do the campaign. And then I had to go back to Tom's Shoes people and say, these are the people that are available. They've raised their hand. They want to do this. It makes sense. Now it's up to them to review it.
They want to do what? They want to write about Tom's.
Oh, so at this stage, they haven't been hired yet. They're just being vetted, pre-vetted by us and then vetted by
To do Tom's. What? That's the part I'm not following.
Right. So let's skip forward to the hired part, right? If you get hired for a month-long campaign, it would usually involve 3 to 4 major pieces of content. So that's like either an article or a video or like Google Hangout where you interview Tom's Shoes founder or whatever it was, right? And then you have 30 or 40 people creating 3 to 4 major pieces of content that month, right? And then each of those 30 or 40 people is sharing all of those pieces of content. So you're like, 30 people, this feverish activity of just kind of pushing out
which
a lot
influencer
of
influencer marketing, essentially, right? Influencer they're paying marketing, for these influencers to be creative and come up with content that they will then share about the companies who are paying them. You take a percentage for making that introduction. They get to keep it. At the time, this was pretty controversial, I guess is the right word. I remember Jason Calacanis going after, who was it, Ted there was another guy who did this, and Jason Calacanis used to go and attack him. You should not be paying for content. Blogging needs to be, right?
Isaiah, right? Ted, right. Ted, Jesus.
I'll find his name.
I know the guy.
Ted Murphy.
Anyways, Ted Murphy, that's it. I mean, listen, it's fine. As long as it's all transparent.
Today it's accepted completely, right? I'm about to interview a company's founder who's now doing, I think, $10 million just selling teeth whitening. And the way that he promotes it is by paying Kardashians and other people to hold up his tooth whitening thing on their Instagrams. That's his marketing.
I mean, how's that different from Michael Jordan advertising and being a spokesperson for Hanes or for Nike or anything like that, right?
Well, the way that they were saying it is kind of like a New York Times article talking about Tom's, which frankly now happens too. not right. about Tom specifically, but even the New York Times is doing it. But at the time they said, you know what, this actually takes the reputation of all bloggers down. People are going to think that anything they read in a blog is not real, it's artificial, it's paid.
Right.
So I get the controversy. It sounds like that wasn't a big issue for you. By the time you were doing this, it was accepted, right?
No. yeah, how naive those times were, right?
Right.
But I mean, that was 3 years ago. The way we got around all of that, because it's just all about transparency and honesty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first pieces of content that we would ask our influencers to write is the announcement that they are now a spokesperson with Tom's Shoes or whoever it was, and that they're going to be joining this campaign and sort of announce it to their community, right? And then in the next piece of content, you know, we ask them to not only be transparent, but brag about the fact that you are now a spokesperson
right.
for Al May or yes. whatever, right? And then we really focused on creative kind of content. So when we ran a Mother's Day campaign for Al May, that was our first campaign. That was like 2013 or something like that. And then we did it again in 2014. We were still in the experimental stage, mm-hmm. And we hired, I don't know, maybe 15 influencers to write about the exclusively moms to write about their how they learned about makeup. That was the theme of the campaign. To write about the experience of being, I don't know, 12, 13 years old and learning how to put on makeup with your mom, mm-hmm. right? So this one person didn't have that experience. And instead, because, you know, not everybody grows up to have a mom. Not everyone's lucky like that, right? So instead, she wrote about how she did it with her daughter, like recently, right? So she just kind of flipped it around. And it was just the most amazing piece of content, right? And it was all transparent and, you know, just you put it all out there. And people didn't find that odd or disturbing or disagreeable by and large.
You told our producer, look, I'll be honest with you, our user experience was pretty crappy the whole way through, but we did well in spite of our UX. Why? What was the thing that got you to that got people to like you so much that despite your user experience, they still stuck with it?
It produced results for them, right? In 2011, 2012, shares were huge. Like in 2013, companies started to really understand social media and start to use it. Like if in 2013, 14, if you are without a Facebook page and you're a company or a brand, like you're crazy, right? But 2011, that was still kind of like, what's this thing, right? So at that time, for a relatively new blogger, and that was our thing. We went in at the bottom of the market,
mm-hmm.
right? Because big bloggers don't need us. They already have an audience. We went to the bottom of the market, people who needed us, and you give them a way to amplify their content effectively, easily, quickly. I mean, you know, they'll knock the door down to get in. That's what it was.
I remember when I was starting, especially, I was so hungry to get more views. I'm still hungry to get more views.
Yeah.
I'm coming in tomorrow to record more interviews because it's going to be with Alex Bloomberg I'm recording tomorrow. Mm-hmm. He's the founder of Gimlet. I feel like that's going to elevate us and get us more traffic. The founder of Warby Parker on Friday, the day that I was going to not record and let myself grow a little bit of a beard and work, right? I'm doing all that to just get people to come and view. I get it. I get the pain and I get the determination and the willingness to do anything to get more people to view and frankly, also to do good work.
Yeah.
You, I get all that. You then decided you wanted to sell. And it's partially because you were stuck. You were working very hard and you couldn't raise any money. Why couldn't you raise money? You guys had a business that was real.
Yeah, there were a few things about raising money that I didn't know at the time. There's no four-year-old startup. Right? There's not even a three- or two-year-old startup. You have a kind of a four-year failure. At least that's how investors view it, right? If you're 4 years in and you haven't reached scale, what are you doing, right? Meanwhile, we had a fairly healthy business that was doing pretty well. So we were old, and we were not in the right space either, largely because you couldn't kind of even nail down our space. Is it like social media? Is it influence marketing? Is it publishing?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like we were kind of a you know, out there. And then when I went to raise money, it was in the fall of 2014, I think. And that was just terrible. Maybe 2015. I forget now. But it was like September, November timeframe. Don't try to raise money in September, November timeframe. No one told me this. Like, investors are gone, man. It's Thanksgiving. Holidays are coming up. December, everybody just checks out. There's a season for everything. In springtime, like now, we're in February, right? So starting to have conversations with investors and sort of getting a term sheet come springtime. That's a realistic time frame, and that's a realistic season to do it in. Summertime, everyone's gone on vacation. It's gone. End of summertime, before you really get into like deep fall, you may have another window. So in any case, our timing
was completely wrong. So that was it. It was, you guys, old as a company, 4 years old,
yep.
Right? So it's harder to raise seed money, you felt. You also thought that it's the wrong time of the year to do it, and you were not in a sexy space anymore.
That's fair, yeah.
Okay. And so instead, you said, look, I just don't have it right now. I got to sell. And so you came up with this interesting plan, this marketing PR campaign to get yourself sold. Talk about that. What was that?
Yeah. So Dan and I decided to sell. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we have, and you could go out and say, hey, Andrew, you want to buy Triber? Like, you could do that.
Which is very pathetic. It would not
work. Very pathetic, and it doesn't really put you in a good position, right? Much better position would be for you to come to me and say, hey, Dino, you want to sell Triber? You know what I mean? So we tried it the wrong way. That didn't work. And we're like, okay, so how do you do this the right way? How do I get you to come to me and talk to me about potentially buying a company? What we did is we looked at the people that we were targeting. So probably like a strategic business person, probably in a mature company that's looking to enter sort of a new space, jump into this little bubble that's growing and whatnot. If you understand who your target audience is, you have to ask yourself a question, where are they? Right? And for us, the answer was, well, these guys are reading Business Insider, TechCrunch, VentureBeat, these types of publications. All right. So if they're reading that, then how do we get ourselves in front of them, right? Mm-hmm. And then you look at TechCrunch, VentureBeat, all these guys, and you see what they're writing about, right? There's basically like three categories. There's someone got acquired,
yep.
Someone raised money, and then miscellaneous. Right? There's like everything else. So we knew that if we were to raise money, we'd probably be able to get a write-up. That's, you know, that would be fairly easy. We knew that if we would get acquired, which was the goal, that might get a mention. And we were like, what if we were to acquire somebody? Like, no way. We can't acquire. We're not, you know what I mean? Like, we're not that far ahead to go and acquire somebody. But it's a crazy enough idea that it might work. So I did some sleuthing. I found a bunch of, let's call them targets.
Company acquisition targets.
Company acquisition targets, yeah. And we found one that was sort of in our sweet spot. We didn't pay a lot of money for it. It was in our space, came with a good list. It was around for a while. They had a good tech that was being neglected, and we felt we could probably save it. And we worked out a really nice deal with Scoutel Gottfried out of Amsterdam.
How'd you find them?
I mean, you know, you name it. I looked everywhere, right? Gottfried, I found him somehow on LinkedIn. But I've looked everywhere.
You're like, just looking to see where are the companies that are small enough and under capitalized that we can maybe take over.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, I'm in a really sort of a nice position because I get to talk to a lot of people. I know a lot of people, and I you can talk to someone and say, this is what we're trying to do, and they can sort of advise you and send you the right path and whatnot. So I was doing everything I can think of. We found a company to acquire. We acquired it. I went to VentureBeat and TechCrunch and all these guys. And I'm like, hey, guys, this is happening. We're going to announce it and give you an exclusive if you like. VentureBeat jumped on that.
And I've got the article here from VentureBeat. I read it in researching you, okay?
Uh-huh. Yeah. VentureBeat wrote about it. And then we blew it up on Triber, right? Because it's a sharing platform, right? All we needed was like a credible place for us to sort of, you know, be featured in.
Yep.
Once that happened, we blew it up on Triber. In the first week, there were over 5,000 shares on that article. Like, it was hugely shared article. And then VentureBeat, I think they switched their sharing plugin so that, like, zeroize all the shares.
Yes, yeah.
So that happened. It's too bad, but whatever.
The numbers on their website that shows how many times an article was shared.
They're lower.
Set to zero. Yeah. I think that might have been, like, a Twitter thing that caused them to do that. I forget.
Could be, yeah. Yeah.
Issue where Twitter forced to zero. But then, you know what? When I read this in prepping for you, I said, he was trying to grow the company at that point. I imagine other people who are reading it would say, this guy bought a company, he's growing his business. They wouldn't think that you were an acquisition target. It would seem to put you in a different light. Am I right?
I think so. I think you're right. Like, if somebody was to give it a deeper thought, I think that might be a conclusion.
And so doesn't that undo your goal, which is to raise your profile so people come to you and say, hey, can we buy you?
You know, it could have gone either way. And I'm sure 50% of people went that way. The other 50 went the other way. But I'll tell you what happened. We actually, from that article, right, and from blowing it up and sort of putting it in front of people that could read it. So there's like a Facebook ad you target. Back then, you could import custom emails. It was doing a lot of creative stuff to make the right person aware that A, we exist, and B, we are somebody that you should be talking to, right? So one of the companies that we ended up partnering as a result of that was Tap Influence, which was one of our competitors, actually. Mm-hmm. But it was like the best. Andrew, if you can partner with your competition, you're onto something.
Okay.
Like, that's one thing that I've learned about business. If you can partner with competition, you're onto something. So that was a great partnership. And, you know, we were sniffing around each other for a potential acquisition. Didn't work out. There was a Canadian PR company. Maybe I shouldn't mention them.
Okay.
They were talking to us as a potential partnership that came out of that article, and that would have led to an acquisition if it went anywhere, but it didn't. But the article was working. That was the indicator. We got an offer from another company. We couldn't close in 2 months. And when it comes to acquisitions and any of these partnership deals or whatever, there's like a million things that can go wrong, right?
Okay.
So that didn't work out. But then 99 Robots came in, and we managed to close in like 30 days.
Why did 99 Robots come to you? It's a dev shop, isn't it?
They're the perfect people to take on Triber and grow it and whatnot.
So why did they want to come to you?
Well, because they're a dev shop, right? So they're not afraid of the technology that went into Triber. Okay. They got that covered. But then their product is WordPress plugins.
Mm-hmm. And services too, don't they?
And services, right? Yeah.
So they'll do web development for you, like WordPress, Shopify development. I'm looking at their website, but they also have a collection of plugins that you can buy from them.
That's right.
Okay.
And who's got who needs plugins?
Triber. I see your Triber bloggers. So they came to you, and did they say, can we partner? Or did they come to you and say, we read this article, we want to buy
it? Straight up acquisition. No.
Straight up acquisition.
Straight up acquisition, yeah.
They just said, we're looking to acquire companies. I see you got on their radar. Do you think it was a VentureBeat article that got you on the radar?
No. Charlie is the CEO of 99 Robots. He's actually someone I've known for years. He was somebody that was sort of close to the company, knew what was going on. We're personal friends, right? So he sees what was going on. He knew that we were selling it. And then he knew that it didn't work out. He was like, great.
I see. And how did he know that you guys were selling it?
We're personal friends.
You're just being open to him and say, look, I think we're selling it. Got it. That actually is a good way to sell it, to say, hey, I've got some offers from people. It's not, hey, Andrew, do you want to buy? But, hey, Andrew, there are a bunch of people who are making offers. Do you have some advice? Can you give me some guidance? I see. By the way, what a clever idea to get PR from the tech crowd to just go and acquire a company just for the PR. And a small acquisition, too.
People must be doing that more often. Like, I can't be the guy that invented that. It's got to be clever. A common thing, right? I hope. I think. Anyways.
All right. If anyone wants to follow up with you directly, what they could do is just go to DinoDogan, DOGAN.com, right? And now they actually know how they could book themselves with you because you accidentally mentioned it. Are you going to be upset that now that's out there?
No, I don't care.
No, good. I'm glad.
I've had my phone number and my email online for like 10 years. No one's emailing me. No one's calling me. No one cares.
All right. Good point. So there it is. DinoDogan.com. We had two different sponsors in this interview. The first one is the company that will help you hire your next great developer. They also do designers, MBAs, etc. It's called TopTal, TOPTAL.com/MixerG. I keep talking about them because you guys keep signing up for them because they do good service. Go check out TopTal.com/MixerG. And whenever I want to talk to my customers or want to make it easy for my customers to talk to me or, frankly, any conversation, except for hookups, I don't do that, I use Acuity Scheduling, and we have a special offer for anyone who's listening, a lot of free time on Acuity Scheduling. Check them out at AcuityScheduling.com. That is AcuityScheduling.com/MixerG. Thanks, everyone, for being a part of MixerG. Bye, everyone.